It's a very sweet story you all heard. The bad guys tried to gang up on us. The poor victimized Jews, we fought back. We prevailed. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. Let's have latkes. That's kind of the story we're familiar with. And we're also familiar with the fact that Hanukkah is quite popular. Anybody know the parallel holiday to Hanukkah? What is the parallel holiday, the most similarly instituted Jewish holiday to Hanukkah?
Purim.
Why is it so similar to Purim? It's rabbinic. It's post-biblical. Right? And it's not mentioned anywhere in the Torah or anything like that. And yet, which holiday is more popular here in the United States?
Hanukkah.
Hanukkah is a lot more popular. They're identical. Purim's a lot of fun. But it doesn't get celebrated by nearly as many Jews. Anybody know why?
Because you don't get presents on Christmas.
Because of Christmas. It has nothing to do with Hanukkah. It has nothing to do with Purim. It has everything to do with its proximity to Christmas.
Does Hanukkah have to do that it's 8 days of Purim?
Oh, that's interesting. Purim's just one day, so you would figure, I don't know, you could argue that both ways, you know? You could say, oh, maybe it gets diffused because it's so long. Purim is one big day of drinking right now. So I don't believe in coincidences. And for some reason, this holiday was popularized, not by our own people, but by a great Christian holiday that happens to fall out alongside Hanukkah, which, by the way, Christmas would never exist if it wasn't Hanukkah, you should realize. We'll get to that too. So I want to talk a little about the story, and I want to understand the irony in the actual story of Hanukkah to the fact that it has been popularized by Christmas. Because they're very much connected, actually. Now, what is the story? And I need to take you back into history. And tonight's class can be a little different. We're going to do a little... We're going to wax historical a bit so you can understand the story. And then we're going to understand also through the very minimum way that we celebrate. It's just lighting a menorah. It's very... Say a few prayers, light a menorah. Our lives don't change so much. Not like Pesach, you know, or Sukkot even. So we're going to talk a little about that as well. So, when did this story take place? So, who built the first temple?
Solomon.
King Solomon built the first temple, and it lasted for approximately 410 years. You don't have to get all these details, but I want to give you a little historical landmark so you can get what I'm talking about. That temple was destroyed by who? Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of which country?
Babylon.
Babylonia was a superpower. They destroyed the first temple, deporting the survivors to Babylon, which was basically, you know, modern-day Iraq, which is where most Jews lived for the next how many years? How long did that diaspora last? Not too long. 70 years. Until, and that's where the Purim story comes in, the Purim story, okay? The Jewish people... Correct. The Purim story takes place at the tail end of that 70-year period. Okay? And the Jewish people are finally allowed back to go to Israel under the new tolerant Persian Empire. Remember, the Babylonian Empire was toppled by the Persian Empire. And it was under Darius, who some claim was the son of Esther and Ahasuerus. It's not historically backed up 100%, but some believe that. Jews come back to Israel and they build themselves a new temple, a second temple, which Herod, the egomaniac Donald Trump of yesteryear, that's what the Israeli tour guides like to say every time you go to a place. This was built by Herod, who was the Donald Trump of yesteryear. I heard like five Israeli tour guides say that. Herod was the guy who doubled the size of the temple. The Temple Mount that we have, if you heard Rabbi Feldman's speech last week, it's much larger than the first temple was. He actually built up the whole mountain. It's much more magnificent. And he had like great complexes and he built big buildings as a result. And that temple stood for 420 years. This story that we're jumping into, the Hanukkah story, is taking place about 200 years into the second temple, about smack in the middle of the second temple, during whose reign? Because after the Persians toppled the Babylonians, who came after the Persians? The Greeks. Okay. Now, the Greeks came, and after Alexander the Great swept the ancient Near East, and he was killed, his top three generals took over and ultimately divided his kingdom into three parts. And the part where the Jews were living, which is called... If I go like that, that means you...
Answer.
You answer. Judea, Israel, right? Okay, the part where the Jews lived, because Jews came back and they were worshiping God in the temple and everything was okay. Except, you know, they were living under, you know, empires. I mean, they didn't really have their own sovereignty. And certainly not under the Greek Empire. So Alexander the Great's reign was split up, and one of the three areas was called the Seleucids. They had control over Syria. The Syrian Seleucids won out over Jerusalem. And from the Ptolemies, Silent P, who first governed Jerusalem. The Syrian prince of the Seleucid Greek Empire, okay? His name was, who's the bad dude in the Hanukkah story? What's his name? Right? Achash. No? Achashverosh is the bad dude in the Purim story, or Haman, right? Who's the bad dude in the Hanukkah story? His name was? Antiochus. Who was a Greek ruler over Judea, where the Jews were living when the Second Temple stood. He himself was very ambitious. He hoped to expand Greek culture and Greek religion throughout his territories. He was very unstable. He was known to display extreme displays of cruelty on one side and generosity on the other. He was the one to introduce the barbaric Roman customs that ultimately became the gladiator games into the Syrian Seleucid Empire. He would leave his throne at banquets to dance in the nude with the entertainers. He was quite a personality. Now, the Jews were living under Antiochus. And what was the deal with the Jews? Who were they? What was going on? Now, they were getting sucked into the culture in which they were living. Now, the culture in which they were living is not Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle, like you might be thinking when you hear Greece. We're not talking about highfalutin philosophy, we're talking about paganism in its most banal, primitive form. Idol worship, sexual promiscuity, and all sorts of interesting things being done, all surrounded around the philosophy that we worship the body. This is where you get Hercules and Zeus, these Greek gods with the perfect physiques and bodies, because they worshipped the physical, and anything that didn't sort of subscribe to the physical, they had really no business, you know, with this. Two extra chairs over here, gentlemen. Come. So please help yourselves. You want to just come. So I'm giving you this background for a very important reason, and you'll see if there are any contemporary things that are going on here. Now, who was the leader in the Jewish community back then? During the temple days, like, who would you say is the most important Jewish leader during the temple times?
The high priest.
The high priest, good. The high priest at the time was a gentleman by the name of Shimon. He was called Shimon HaTzadik because he was so righteous. And under him, his son then took over. His name was Chonyo, who was the rightful Kohen Gadol. Chonyo's brother became a Hellenized Jew. What's a Hellenized Jew? Right. He got into the whole Greek thing in a very, very passionate kind of way. And this whole ideology was sweeping the ancient Near East. So Jews were getting sort of sucked into this. And Chonyo had a brother who changed his name to Jason. I kid you not. Sounds so contemporary. Right? His name was Jason. And he had Hellenized his name. And he offered Antiochus a bribe to depose his own brother Chonyo and to be elected, if you will, it's not an appointed position, the new high priest, so that he could do what? So he could bring more Hellenism into the Jewish community. And when Chonyo protested this, he was killed. Jason promised the king more money, another 150 talents of silver, if he would authorize the building of a gymnasium This is not just a place to work out and, you know, reduce some stress after a long day. But these gymnasiums were popping up all over the ancient Near East. They were places of idol worship. The games were played in the nude. This is ultimately what later gave rise to the Olympic Games and the whole sort of worship of the physique and sports and athletics.
Does that pose a modern day halachic issue by observing Olympic Games?
No, I don't. I mean, today it's so removed from that, but this is kind of the roots of it. So Jason promises the king more money if he would authorize the building of a gymnasium for the youth of Jerusalem, and if he would consider the people of Jerusalem honorary citizens of Antioch. What is Jason trying to do? He's trying to curry favor with the Greek leaders because he wants to be seen as Greek first and Jew second. Jason builds this gymnasium closer to the temple, and cultivating the practices of the Greek pagan customs to such an extent that the Kohanim, the young men who were serving as priests in the Jewish temple, were being lured away from the Jewish temple into these Greek centers of paganism in these gymnasiums, and beginning to neglect the avodah in the Beit HaMikdash, the Jewish service in the temple, in favor of Jason's new centers of diversion. And all this information, by the way, is readily available. It's in history books. There is very little history in the Talmud about this, and I'll read you the only thing the Talmud says about the whole holiday of Hanukkah. Because if I asked you right now, what are you familiar with the holiday of Hanukkah? What little miracle? The little flask of oil. And we're not even anywhere near there. That's the only thing most of us, and honestly me, myself growing up, the only thing I ever heard about this holiday. I didn't hear anything about Jason and gymnasiums. And Josephus, anybody hear of Josephus? Josephus Flavius was a great, very controversial figure, but an important historian who was a Hellenized Jew in his own right, according to most historians. And he says that the Jewish boys in these gymnasiums took pains to disguise their circumcisions because the games were held in the nude, sacrifices were offered up to Hercules and to other Greek gods. And in order to qualify as an honorary citizen of Antioch, which was the Syrian Seleucid Greek capital, Jews had to demonstrate total acceptance of the Greek way of life. Now, until this point, Jews were not being forced to give up Judaism. Nobody was putting a gun to the Jewish head and saying, no more Torah for you, you got to follow our ways. That's not what was happening. What was happening was Jews on their own were getting sucked into another culture, another ideology that was antithetical to Judaism. Not everybody, but a sizable number of Jews. And some of them were really trying to curry serious favor with the Greek officials, like Jason was. In 171 BCE, Jason was removed from office by Antiochus. He became the new high priest. Of course, the high priest already was corrupted. You can't have a high priest who's a pagan, who doesn't believe in any of this stuff, and is just doing it for some other reason. And he was ultimately replaced by Millenius, who was a bigger crook and a greater self-hating Jew. Millenius, who was once an emissary of Jason, who used his position to undermine Jason. They were fighting against each other. He took over the kahuna, the priesthood. And in order to pay off the huge debt that was owed to Millenius, that was owed to Antiochus, don't worry if you're not getting all these facts, I just want you to get a little sense from the details. Millenius and his brother Lysimachus, you tell me a Jew whose name is Lysimachus or Millenius, they all became Greeks. Right? They took the gold vessels of the temple and they used them to raise money to pay off Antiochus. This is what was happening in the Jewish community. And when Chonio, the real Kohen Gadol, protested, I mentioned before, he was murdered. And that's ultimately what gave way to what began as a very serious opposition. A Jewish revolt began. Because what ended up happening was that even though the Greeks didn't start by putting a gun to our head, little by little, that's ultimately what happened. A growing opposition to Millenius and Lysimachus arose amongst the Jews of Jerusalem. The rabbis openly preached against Hellenism. They arose in a revolt and they defeated, and there were actual battles and wars. And Lysimachus was killed. And those who revolted sent emissaries to Antiochus demanding the removal of Millenius, but he was able to flatter and bribe the king or emperor, I don't know, whatever you called Antiochus. He was a tyrant. And Millenius put to death many of his rabbinic foes who openly preached against him in Hellenism. Jason tried to seize the opportunity. They were fighting amongst themselves to seize power and get himself back in as the Kohen Gadol. He organized an army and attacked Jerusalem and captured it from Millenius's army. Everybody was trying to show and prove who could be more a loyalist to Greece, you know, than the next. And these are all Jews. But Millenius and his forces escaped to Acre, which is a military fortress. And I don't have to go on and on. And here's eventually what ended up happening was that he entered the temple, the Jewish temple, and pillaged the vessels and the gold of the temple. And they forcibly reinstated a Hellenist as a high priest. And they sent soldiers essentially to surround Jerusalem. They massacred innocent Jews. They breached the temple walls in 13 different places, forbade Jews to repair the breaches. Greek temples and altars were placed all throughout Jerusalem, and it became a rule that you would die under penalty of death. You were not permitted to preach that you were a Jew, not permitted to study Torah publicly, circumcision, the observance of Rosh Chodesh, of the Sabbath, and of key Jewish festivals were publicly prohibited under penalty of death. There was a decree that was passed that required Jews to offer pigs in sacrifices, which is not a permissible animal to bring on a Jewish altar, at these altars that were set up throughout ancient Judea. And this is what was happening, and this is what was going on. Until there was one man. It all starts with one person. Yeah?
You just mentioned ancient altars, plural. My understanding was the sacrifice had already been done at the temple.
Correct.
According to Talmud, there were two others, but they were outside of this.
Correct. Correct. What the Greeks did was they created their own. First of all, they went into the Jewish temple, and they seized it, and they started bringing unclean animals and forcibly, you know, requiring Jews to do that in the temple and throughout ancient Judea on these altars. But you're correct, Jews didn't bring sacrifice outside of the temple itself. Now this all continued until one man, whose name was Matityahu, has anybody heard of him? Who was the son of Yochanan, who was previously the high priest. He left Judea, Yushalayim, and he settled in Modin, which is a Judean village. And he refused to sacrifice to the idol that was set up in that town. And there was a Jew about to bring a sacrifice, about to offer a hog publicly to a Greek god. And he killed the man. And he declared publicly that who is zealous for the Torah and steadfast in the covenant, let him follow me. And his five sons basically rescued their older father and fled with him to the mountains in the Judean desert where they began the revolt. There were many other loyal Jews that followed their example and joined him to live in the mountains where they could practice Judaism and maintain their observances and figure out some kind of way of trying to expel the Greeks from what was happening. The king's forces had to deal with this challenge to the Antiochus's authority, and they began looking for these Jews hiding out in the Judean hills. There were approximately 6,000 Jews that gathered under Matityahu's banner, and they began to strike back at night raids. And they would destroy the idolatrous altars that the pagan Greeks would set up. And the revolt had begun. And by the time Matityahu died in 165 BCE, the war against the Syrian Greeks was in full force. He had five sons. You probably have heard of the most famous one. One of his sons was Shimon. He was the oldest, Yehuda HaMaccabee, who was, they were told to follow the advice of Shimon because he was supposed to be the wisest, but to look to Judah the Maccabee, Yehuda HaMaccabee, as their leader in battle. Eliezer, Elazar, Yochanan, and Yonatan were the other sons. And you can read about the fights and the battles. They were real. Apollonius gathered soldiers and others to attack Judah, but Judah was forewarned. He struck in advance, killing Apollonius and much of his armies. He took their arms, and they started getting bigger, and the revolt started developing a reputation because they were starting to become successful against the Greeks. The Siron, who was the commander of the Syrian army, heard about this, figured he could make a great name for himself. He was put in charge of the revolt, and he gathered a well-equipped army. They marched into Judea. Judah split up his forces into different sort of like divide and conquer, and it was guerrilla tactics, basically striking at night in smaller forces. And there were two other generals that the Greeks sent in, Philip and Apollonius, who tried to destroy the these were called the Hasmonaim or the Hasmoneans forces. This was a family of Kohanim, by the way. And instead suffered serious setbacks. Antiochus then sent another general. This kept happening and happening and happening. Until one of the most important battles was fought. Lysias appointed three of Syria's best generals, Ptolemy, Nicanor, and Gorgias, to lead the Judean campaign and put them in charge of an army of 40,000 foot soldiers and 7,000 cavalry. I'm just trying to give you a little sense. This was big. 7,000 people on horses. Daron, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, cool. My brother was just calling on the other line, that's all. Just wonder, maybe you guys were talking, I don't know. So, Ptolemy, Nicanor, and Gorgias are leading 40,000 foot soldiers, 7,000 cavalry, and they marched. He's still there. They marched into Judea, and they were so confident that they would win that Nicanor, one of those three generals, summoned Gentile slave owners along the coastal cities and promised them Jewish slaves at unprecedented low prices. Because what happens when you defeat an enemy? You get to sell their, you get to sell the defeated into slavery, make a lot of money. And he said, "Don't worry, we're gonna wipe them out once and for all." And who was successful? The Jews were successful in that battle. Amazing courage and some military deception. Yehuda outmaneuvered the far larger Syrian army. He split up his own forces, placing each of his battalion under the leadership of another one of his brothers. He forced the Syrian forces to divide and destroyed the smaller components, killing thousands and forcing the survivors to flee north to Syria. In fact, when in 1948 and later in 1967, when they wanted to make an analogy, when was the last time that the Jewish people were ever so successful in battle? As we say in the prayers, Ma'atim biyad rabim, a few against the many, and nonetheless so successful. This was the last time. And it was an unbelievable victory. And what happened immediately when the Jewish people were victorious in becoming the only ethnicity and the only minority group ever to expel the Greek Empire from their midst? Yeah? We were the only ones. What did we do? What was the first thing we did? Sat down and had a l'chaim? No, what did we do? We went into the temple. Why did we go into the temple? To clean it up of all the schmutz. Okay? And what are you supposed to have lit in the temple every day that unfortunately was not able to be lit in all these years that it was taken over and paganized, if you will? The menorah. And there was, miraculously, there was only one little cruse of oil. And somehow it lasted 8 days, long enough time for the Jews to obtain fresh supplies. And that's the holiday. So I have one simple question for you. I just spent like the last, I can't tell, I don't know, 15 minutes going through a lot of Greek-sounding names and sounding really learned and knowledgeable. I'm just reading from my notes, and I got this from Josephus and other historical works. Why is it that most of us have zero idea about all of these little battles and defeats and guerrilla warfare and the fact that this started really with us and not with some trying to... Now, look, the Greeks were colonizers, clearly. They were imperialists. They ruled over, you know, they were superpower. And they were an ancient superpower, so they weren't terribly kind to the people that they colonized. But we have this vision of like, you know, we were just practicing keeping Shabbos and these bad guys came along and said, no more Shabbos. And yet, it seems like it started with us. And it you know, snowballed into this huge revolt that where ultimately, yeah, they told us either, you know, follow Greek culture or die. But why is it that the only... And you want to know why the only thing we know about this story is the story of the flask of oil. Can I just grab one of... Just hand me one of those. You know why? Because the only thing that the whole Talmud which has a lot of information about a lot of Jewish stuff, says about Hanukkah. Take a look on your handout. Talmud 21b. What is the reason of Hanukkah? Why do we observe Hanukkah? For our rabbis taught, on the 25th of Kislev, right, it's the month we're in now, commence the days of Hanukkah, which are eight on which a lamentation for the dead and fasting are forbidden. So the Talmud tells us that on Hanukkah you're not supposed to, if someone, God forbid, passes away, at the funeral you shouldn't have a eulogy, because it shouldn't be overly drawn out, because it's such a joyous time. But why? What happened? Because when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all the oils, and when the Hasmonean dynasty prevailed against them and defeated them, they made search and found only one cruse of oil, which lay with the seal of the high priest, by which contained sufficient, but which contained sufficient for one day's lighting only. Yet a miracle was wrought, and they lit the lamp, therefore, for 8 days. The following year, these days were appointed a festival with a recital of Hallel and Thanksgiving. So that's the only thing. I mean, we kick butt. Why don't we have any of this stuff mentioned? Why is it that when you went to Hebrew school, we didn't get the details of this story? Why is it that the only thing most of us know about is a little fakakta thing of oil? That when they went in and they needed to light the menorah, and they didn't have enough, it somehow miraculously lasted for 8 days. I mean, it's sweet, it's beautiful, but compared to a small, tiny minority defeating the Greek Empire, kicking them out, and regaining political sovereignty for the Jewish people, by the way, which we had for another 200 years, right, since until the Romans came in and kicked our butts, excuse me, and pushed us out of Israel. And we remained that way for the last 2,000 years till we came back in 1948. Last time we had political independence since the creation of the modern state of Israel in 48 was the Hanukkah story. Why don't we know about this? Now, we don't know about this because there's no Jewish sources. I had to get all this information from secular sources. Isn't this something that we want to talk about? Not maybe boast over, but at least know about and understand when we talk about Hanukkah what this, what the story was really about. What do you think? What are we going to say, Roger? Yeah.
Is it because in there, kicking the Greeks out, they kind of overzealously went on a conquering spree, and that's the only time where they forcibly converted people to Judaism, and that's what led to Herod situation, like they converted Antipater, and then like that's kind of like a sin in of itself.
Okay, so one practical reason could be that we're not proud of everything that the Maccabees did, particularly after the war. But, you know, that's so we can't talk about anything awesome that they did beforehand. But it is one theory that's advanced, and I think that historically that makes a lot of sense. What other reasons would you think? Yeah.
I mean, it was a period of incredible strife within the Jewish community.
Yeah. So I think that could very well be a reason. The only problem with that is that if you've ever been here on Tisha B'Av, for the last 14 years I've taught the same passage in the Talmud having to do with Tisha B'Av that talks about all the terrible strife that went on in Jerusalem 200 years later when the Romans came in. And the rabbis are not shy about sharing all the details of that controversy. Yeah, the Torah is filled with all this stuff. I didn't even share this. You talked about how do we know the Torah comes from God. I know it couldn't have been written by man, because who would be that blatantly and brutally honest? You know, no ancients recorded every mistake they made like the Torah has. Now, that doesn't prove it comes from God, but I'm just saying this in response to your suggestion, which is, you know, it's a little odd that they would reveal so much controversy and inner conflict, you know, there, and why not here? Now, another classic reason that's offered is because if that was what you and I grew up thinking Hanukkah was about, they tried to kill us and we outmaneuvered them and we were pretty awesome, then what concern as a rabbi or a sage of the Talmud might you have in not, and therefore deciding maybe not to include all the details of that war and end up focusing on what?
focusing on
military.
On right, focusing on the spiritual. So think about this, and it does go back to something you said before, which I think is very true. What is this holiday really celebrating? Because I think the rabbis left it out purposely, so that we wouldn't misunderstand the point of Hanukkah. Because when you get into the whole battles and the details and da-da-da, and we get all excited about that, and oh yeah, and the little flask of oil, you start thinking this holiday is about the physical survival of the Jewish people. They tried to physically destroy us. But that's not what Hanukkah celebrates. What holiday does celebrate the physical survival of the Jewish people? We said it before. Purim. Haman and Achashverosh, with Achashverosh's consent, tried to destroy physically. Haman was out to annihilate Jews, not Judaism. He didn't care if you gave up your Judaism. He was like a Hitler. Right? If you decided to convert to Christianity or to any other religion that Hitler would have liked, would it have mattered? Would it have mattered to Haman? No. He was intent on destroying Jews, irrespective of their ideology. Hanukkah is totally different. Hanukkah is all about ideology. It's all about philosophy. It's all about the religion. In fact, there wouldn't have been a revolt, by the way. There wouldn't have to have been a revolt if the Jews had just done what? Right? They don't even have to convert. They just have to stop keeping Shabbos. They have to stop keeping kosher and bring a couple of animals on the Greek altars to show that they're patriotic. In fact, the only reason there was a war was not to protect the physical survival. I would argue just the opposite. Being religious threatened the physical survival of the Jewish people. The best way to keep yourself alive during that period of time was to kill yourself spiritually. But what did they do? They were willing to fight, not for their lives, but for their religion. And Hanukkah, ultimately, is a celebration of the spiritual survival of the Jewish people. And that is the ultimate irony in how this particular holiday became popularized by our assimilation into another culture and another faith that causes us to take a little more look at Hanukkah. How weird and strange is that? And I came across this idea when I was reading one of my favorite books that you should all have.
Are you Catholic?
No, but it is one of my favorite books. I have so many favorite books, it's not even fair to say favorite anymore. Take a look to page 3. Anybody read a book called This Is My God?
Yes.
You've read it. How awesome is that book? It's unbelievable. Talk it up a little.
It's been a while, but
I don't get a conviction.
It's been a while.
Herman Wolf, by the way, I'm not this old, but I heard of him growing up a shtickle, okay, because he was a playwright and he wrote, anybody know? Cain Mutiny, thank you. What's that?
Winds of War,
Marjorie, Morning Star. He's a great author and playwright. And when he was 24 years old and he had everything, he was like on the top of the world, American Jew, he decided to start looking into his Judaism. And he wrote this book called This Is My God. It's a great book. I've given it to people looking to explore their Judaism because it's written almost like a novel from the perspective of someone, A, who's an awesome writer, and B, who's sort of coming into it and giving his own. So I turned to Herman Wolk. I looked in the table of contents under Hanukkah and listened to what he writes. You with me? It's really amazing. Oh, by the way, before I get to this, I just want to make the point that I just made a little clearer. So why do the rabbis, perhaps, there are a couple of suggestions we heard, omit all mention of the miracle on the battlefield? Because they don't want us misunderstanding the nature of the holiday. Because then we get sucked into the whole battle, and we would think, again, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. That's what every Jewish holiday gets chalked up to be. And then it becomes about just physically surviving. And we love that. Americans love that story, because that's how America got started. And that's what we love. No, this story is not about physical survival. We would have physically survived much better if we just gave up our Judaism. This is a story that celebrates the spiritual survival, and therefore, how do we celebrate? How do we actually physically celebrate Hanukkah? What do we do? What's the ritual? We light a menorah. How do you physically? I just gave it away. How do you celebrate Purim?
Drinking.
You drink. What else?
Dance.
You dance. There's a specific mitzvah to eat a meal, a suda, right? That's where you're supposed to get drunk. By the way, everybody thinks that the drinking is a mitzvah. The drinking is within the context of the meal, Okay, now the meal though is a special. Is there a mitzvah meal on Hanukkah?
No.
No. We eat latkes because there's oil, and the oil lasted, and we like oily food, so we'll eat it. What's that? Jelly donuts, oil. Oil, oil, oil. Stop eating this stuff, it's terrible for you. But the only reason we eat it is because it's not, there's no mitzvah to eat a meal. You know why? Because we're celebrating spiritual, therefore we light a candle. We say prayers and we light a candle because we are not celebrating the physical survival. Purim, Haman wanted us dead physically. Didn't matter what religion you would join or leave or abandon. And therefore we celebrate Purim by doing what?
By
having a meal. Okay. We drink. Okay. Take a look at Herman Wolk. In 1,000 years of national existence on the soil of Palestine, the Jews over and over drove out oppressors and regained independence. But the Maccabean War, a battle for religious liberty, alone found a place in the rites of our faith. It stood out. It was the Jews' first full-scale encounter with the question that was to haunt them in the next 2,000 years, namely, and this is why this is such an important contemporary holiday for Jews living in 2014. Here's the question, guys. Can a small people dwelling in a triumphant major culture take part in the general life and yet hold it to its identity? I want to read that again. Can a small people dwelling in a triumphant major culture take part in the general life and yet hold to its identity? Or must it be absorbed into the ranks and the ways of the majority? In the two great worlds of current affairs, the communist empire, okay, this was written in the 50s, which so much resembles an ancient military dictatorship, and the tolerant, skeptical free West, that's us, they face the question again. The communist position on the Jews is generally, though with less crudity, that of Antiochus. Our religion, the Soviets consider a barbaric relic, superseded in wisdom and soundness by Marxism. A good Jew. Right? It all started with Jews. The training of children in this exploded Semitic superstition goes against good sense in the interests of the state. So the police discourage such teaching in ways sometimes oblique and sometimes forcible. For Greek religion substitute Marxism, and the Russian Jews are back where their fathers were in 168 BCE, with whatever differences one might find in the relative truth and beauty of the Greek and communist cultures. So he says there's a lot of similarity between modern day communism and what Jews are going through in Russia today, he says, in the 50s, and what happened back in 168 BCE. Let's get to us. Challenge of the West is different, just as serious. The proposition is the old one, that the Jews are confronted with a better way of life and should give up their religion for it. Listen to this line. Forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call forth the human impulse to fight them urge Jews along this path. You see, when no one's pushing you back and no one's telling you you can't do something, there's nothing really what? Right? It's not coercive. Nothing is forcing your impulse to fight. What are you going to fight against? Being loved? The position of the government, and indeed the deep conviction of most American leaders, is that the Jewish community has the right to hold fast to the faith of its fathers and ought to do so. What contradicts them is the tidal wave, turn the page please, the tidal force that D. Torcavelli long ago marked as the great weakness of a democracy in his unforgettable phrase, the tyranny of the majority. You know what the tyranny of the majority D. Torcavelli was talking about, basically? It's like a fancy way of saying peer pressure. It's what everybody else is doing. The pressure to emulate neighbors, the urge to conform to popular views and manners, the deep fear of being different. These in the United States are the force of Antiochus, where the power of the sword long ago failed. The power of suggestion has recently been doing rather better. You know, last year, Alan Dershowitz, who spoke at the lecture I mentioned before, so he said that, you know, as Bezrat Hashem, I mean, anti-Semitism has reared its ugly head again, certainly in Europe. But to the degree that we continue not to find anti-Semitism and to be more accepted, there's going to be a light shined on Judaism. Because what kept Jews Jewish for so long was what? People telling you can't be Jewish. And then when they say, do whatever you want, you're left with a big blank hole. Okay, why should I be Jewish? We never stopped to figure that one out. We were just reminded by our enemies for so long. It would be pleasant to believe, second paragraph, that the stabbing relevance of Hanukkah to Jewish in life has occasioned a swell of interest in the holiday. But a different and perfectly obvious cause is at work. By total accident of timing, this minor Hebrew celebration falls close in the calendar year to a great holy day of the Christian faith. This coincidence has all but created a new Hanukkah. It was entirely natural for a new Jewish generation growing up in the United States to feel each December like children in the dark outside of a home where there was a gay party. He's not using gay like you're thinking. He's using gay from the 1950s. Pressing their noses wistfully. What's that?
It means happy eyes.
Right. Thank you. Where there was a gay party pressing their noses wistfully against the windows. That Judaism had its own rich and varied occasions of gaiety was beside the point. Most second-generation Jews were but poorly trained in their own faith. And anyway, the Christians had a brilliant midwinter feast, and the Jews did not. You imagine like a little kid, his nose pressed up against the window, watching his friends celebrate with a big tree and the jewels. And they're like, everybody's doing this, and this Christmas carol's going. You know, they started after Thanksgiving on the radio already, you know. You don't feel it as much in New York. But go out of town, okay? Or even in New York, back in the 1950s, he said. And everything is going on, and you're schlepping around with your little dreidel. Hey, I got a holiday too. I'll try this, you know? Some families solve the problem in the simplest way by introducing Christmas trees, Christmas presents, and Christmas carols into their homes. They argued that it was harmful for their children to feel underprivileged, and that the Christmas tree was a mere pleasant ornament of the season without religious content. You know what happened from this?
Well,
right, and you can now get a Chrismica gift for your friends, if you would like. Because what's eventually developed out of this whole feeling bad for the children. Okay, and I'm not saying this is what caused it. Okay, caused it was a lack of appreciation for Torah, for Judaism. Because if you appreciate Judaism, I don't care how good that new person sings, you know, Jingle Bells. I've heard it 18 different ways this week. Okay, it's not going to matter. Because you believe in what you believe. And you're surrounded by people who are believing in that, and you're strong. But if you're not terribly well-educated, and most American Jews were not. You know, most of our parents and grandparents did not even have, if they wanted, a Jewish day school to go to. They didn't exist in this country. They're very new. The last 20, 30, 40 years has been a complete explosion of Judaism in this country, particularly in New York City. Our parents and grandparents did not have this. Meantime, in schools where there were large numbers of Jewish children, a dual celebration of Christmas and Hanukkah sprang up as an official symbol of mutual courtesy and tolerance. This in turn generated a new Jewish interest in Hanukkah. Even those Jews who were celebrating Christmas in their homes, trees, holly, born as the King of Israel, and all, that's a Christian song, began to find it seemly to add an electric menorah for their windows and perhaps even to light the candles. This apparently solved the problem by giving the children the best of both worlds. And what ultimately popularized Hanukkah? Christmas. The aggrandizement of Hanukkah itself is a fortunate accident. The level of knowledge of all Judaism must rise when any part of it happens, for whatever reason, to gain attention. The son of my skeptical friend is not likely to stop after learning about Hanukkah. So it's not so bad. Who cares? Fine. They popularize our holiday. Pathetic for us, but at the end, who cares? We got more Jews doing Hanukkah. But a lack of clear and satisfying religious identity hurts American Jews most in December. That is why the apparently trifling issue of the Christmas tree generates with obduracy and such resentment. It rasps an exposed nerve. It's a good thing that Hanukkah is then at hand. If the old custom of Hanukkah money, you ever heard of like Hanukkah Geld, right? Has become the new custom of Hanukkah gifts. Right? That's where gifts came from. Came from Hanukkah Geld. That's a minor shift in manners because everybody else was giving gifts. Okay, we'll do that. The tale of the Feast of Lights, with all of its too sharp comment on our life nowadays, is very colorful. It is of the greatest use in giving the young a quick grasp of the Jewish historic situation. The gifts win their attention. The little candles stimulate their questions. The observance seems tool to the needs of self-discovery. Our whole history is a fantastic legend of a single day's supply of oil lasting 8 days, of a flaming bush that is not consumed, of a national life that the logic of events should have flickered and gone out long ago, but is still burning on. That is the tale we tell our children in the long nights of December, when we kindle the little lights, while the great Christian feast blazes around us with its jewel trees and familiar music. The two festivals have one real point of contact. Had Antiochus succeeded in obliterating Jewry a century and a half before the birth of Jesus, there would have been no Christmas. The feast of the Nativity rests on the victory of Hanukkah.
So good. By the way, the whole book's like this. Just tell you.
It's unbelievable. So I think to take away from our discussion tonight, to think about the irony and what's happening, and to reflect on what I consider to be the most important contemporary Jewish holiday, because we are faced with the same question. Can we, a small minority living amongst a majority culture, which is not holding a gun to our head, which is saying, do whatever you want. It's cool to be different. Everybody thinks it's cool to be different, except the Jew. We want to protect everybody else's right to be different. But it's sometimes we forget what this story was really about and what the Maccabees were ultimately fighting for. They were fighting for our ability to practice our religion freely. Now, to do that, and not to be swept away by the majority culture, which has happened again and again in our history, assimilation is not a new problem. There's only one solution, and it's not more anti-Semitism. And it's not redirecting things to other places. It's knowing what Judaism is about and falling in love with it. Because when you're in love, then you don't cheat. And you don't get lured away. Because you know what you've got. You know the treasure that you have. And that's my blessing really to all of us when we celebrate Hanukkah and we light the menorah this year. And we make those blessings. Right? And we say, Sha'asa nisim la'avotenu, bayamim ahem bazman hazeh, that God performed a miracle. It's the second blessing. What is the miracle? The miracle is not the battle on the fields. That's pretty cool. And you should know about it, to be knowledgeable and learned Jews, about our history. The real miracle is the pach ha-shemen. It's the little flask of oil that lasted 8 days, because that shows the belief in Hashem. Because a military battle, you can get lucky here and there, but a little thing of oil going for 8 days, that either happens because God causes it and wills it to happen, or it doesn't happen. And perhaps that's the reason that's the part of the story that we're more aware of, because we want to celebrate the spiritual victory that's here. And that's really ultimately, I believe, what Hanukkah celebrates. So I know you have a little time between now and Hanukkah. I mentioned before that Rabbi Soloveitchik is speaking next week at 8 o'clock during this time slot. And then the next week already will be the second night of Hanukkah. Oh, and it's our party.
Mm-hmm.
It's our Hanukkah party, which is going to be on the east side. So we're not meeting for a few weeks, and I wanted to get this lesson in beforehand. So I thank you for listening. Any questions or comments, please? I've been doing a lot of talking. Yes, Jamie.
I just wanted to tell you guys that I grew up with a Christmas tree in my house. being very serious, I'm not kidding. And
it's very popular. You don't have to.
I just wanted to say it. But the thing is that it's probably going to take a lot to bring someone who was brought up in that way over to this. And I'm trying to see that road right about now, because I'm just seeing this little tree in which I wrote Santa a letter on, to which he responded by leaving candy canes out the door. Now, if you tell that to a six-year-old kid, you're pretty much, and you mix that with really beautiful music, with resolving notes in major keys, especially with a kid that loves music.
Did you see that, John? Anybody watch John Stewart, you know, on the cable? What am I talking about? What's his name?
John Stewart.
So he had the funniest, exactly. He's Jewish, and he's a little sometimes, making fun of it a little. And he's like, he said exactly what you just said. Oh, let's compare. Which one would you like? Would you like the big Christmas tree and the president like that? And then he takes out like
Bitcoin.
He takes out like Maror from the Seder. And he puts them like next to it. Which one would you like, Junior? You know, whatever.
I don't know. So I guess the question is, how do you go on a Jewish evolution of yourself, especially later on when you've sort of been
Well, this is very important, by the way. The point of this class is not to walk out of here hating Christmas and Christmas keeping Christians. That's ridiculous. The point here is to realize how we can get so easily sucked into whatever's going on, whether it's Hellenism, whether it's Christianity, whatever it is. It's not even really Christianity. It's like Macy's. It's just a shopping spree. It's so commercialized.
Yeah, I mean,
but we, the more substantive, the more Torah you study, I truly believe this, Jamie, the more Torah you study, the more you appreciate who you are as a Jew, the more those other things are not going to look ridiculous, but they're not going to be nearly as attractive, because you understand that it's not just about dreidels and trees. There's something much deeper about our Judaism in terms of the way it can connect us to God and to each other, and the impact that it's had on the world, and we can be part of that. So the more you get into that, the more you realize how incredible it is, and the more the other things around us are not as luring. They're not as, you know, attractive. I'm not saying they're not luring at all, and I'm not saying there aren't wonderful things about other faiths and other religions and other cultures, but there's something pretty awesome about Judaism, and if we can get into that a little more, I think we wouldn't feel like the little kid with his nose pressed up against the window, jealous of his neighbors. You know, question?
As a young Hebrew school girl, I came home crying from Hebrew school because my rabbi told me that during the battles, the Maccabees were actually carrying around Lulav and Esrog, and the holiday is actually that they missed Sukkot and were actually just celebrating Sukkot again.
So I actually heard something really fascinating along those lines. There is some archaeological evidence that I heard this not about the Hanukkah revolt, but about the Great Revolt, which was the Bar Kokhba revolt against the Romans hundreds of years later. That there was some archaeological evidence of some kind of order or shipment of a large number of lulavim and etrogim. The reason I became aware of this is because I was doing a little research about Bar Kokhba, who was also a colorful personality, not necessarily a religious person. And when I mentioned some historical sources that indicated he was not religious, one of the rabbis that I spoke with said, well, what about the shipment of lulavim and esrogim? You know, why would he care about his troops having lulavim and esrogim? Well, it was still good. Lulavim and esrogim, we have 10% left. You're still good, Daron.
Thanks.
You know, why would they care? So, you know, but they clearly were fighting for religious liberty. And I think that's pretty cool, to be caring about a lulav and an etrog. You know? Yeah.
So, in kind of response to what Jamie was saying, I feel like, you know, the Christmas season sort of becomes like, I feel like when I was a kid it was like a month long, now it's like 2 months long, like, it's really like out of control. But it really is one day. And so I feel like if ever I don't remember there was a time that I felt envious, now I'm so neutral because there are so many more enriching things that you experience in Judaism on a regular basis. So even if you're not keeping Shabbos, but if you have regular meals and if you are doing things, you know, celebrating more minor holidays than just like maybe, you know, the three major ones, I feel like that does sort of add to a constant state of the spirit. And I think people really get excited about like the Christmas energy and you know, that kind of like peace on earth, goodwill toward man. Like,
I honestly think, first of all, thank you. And I think the more, again, like what I was saying, I think we're saying the same thing in just different ways, which is that the more you embrace your Judaism, the more you know, and hopefully appreciate what you've embraced, that these other things are not going to be so exciting. But I honestly think it would be such a great thing if we could be good with our religion, comfortable with our Judaism. Because you could appreciate, like, Christmas time, I happen to like it. I think it's very pretty and it's very sweet. People are nicer to each other. They've got deals in the stores. Like, it's all good. I mean, you think about it, right? As long as we don't lose ourselves to some other ethnicity or religion, there's nothing wrong with kind of enjoying the spirit. Which, by the way, as he points at the end, wouldn't exist if there wasn't Judaism or Hanukkah.
Sure.
Yes.
I have a much more practical question. So we are instructed to light the menorah.
Yes.
The Hanukkah. Do you fulfill the mitzvah by watching somebody else doing it in their company and simply saying Amen and watching it? Or should everybody be actually doing the
candle
themselves?
Good. Ideally, you should be doing your own in your own home. If you are sleeping over in someone else's home, for whatever reason, let's say you're visiting your parents,
then you can be mitzaref, which means included in the mitzvah, let's say, whoever's lighting it, the menorah, in your parents' home. You could, and that could be your lighting, and just say amen at the end. But you really should light your own. Also, this is a very good question. Let's say you go to Hanukkah party. Lots of Hanukkah parties in New York. And you go to Hanukkah party, and then they light the menorah. You come to MG's Hanukkah party on two Wednesday nights, we'll also light the menorah. But you might hear us, like, fudging Hashem's name a little, because it's not a real halachic lighting it, because it's supposed to be where?
In
your home. And where is it supposed to be put? By the window. Why? Because there's a mitzvah, what's called Pursume Nisa, which means publicizing the holiday. This is a mitzvah we're supposed to try to demonstrate and share to the world. Now, let's say your home has a beautiful, you know, your windowsill has a beautiful view of the brick wall of the adjacent building, which is what most of us have. Right? Then you could just put the menorah, some say, open up the door of your apartment. Most people are not going to do this either. I'm just going to tell you because it is an option if you want to do it. Open up the door to your apartment and put the menorah across from the mezuzah, where on the entranceway. That's another. Or you can just do it in your apartment. You don't have to do it on the windowsill. We believe today that Pursume Nisa, publicizing, could be for the people in the apartment too. But you shouldn't rely on just going to some party and saying amen for somebody else. You should try to do it yourself. That's a very important mitzvah. Any questions just about, let's just stay on the practical for 1 minute. Any other questions about, what else do we do besides lighting a menorah? And we go up, right? The first night we light one, second, two, three, right? And if you look on the back page, the last page, I gave you the blessings. And how many blessings do you make the first night at Hanukkah?
Three,
good. And then the second, and the subsequent nights, you just make the first two, because the third blessing is Shefiyana, which is you just do in the very beginning. And there's a nice little song after the Hanei Ratanlava, which I have transliterated to you there. What else do we do to celebrate Hanukkah besides lighting the menorah every night of the holiday? We also say two special prayers. One is the Hallel. So if you're praying during the week or on Shabbat during the 8 days, you would add the Hallel. And you're familiar with the Hallel maybe from Rosh Chodesh, Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot. It's the same prayer. Thanksgiving to Hashem for bringing us this great day. It's the Hallel. And what's the second special prayer? It's called the Al Hanisim, which is an insert in two places. Benching, Berkat HaMazon, grace after meals, and the Silent Devotion. I'll say it again. Al Hanisim, it's a short prayer. And you insert that into your silent devotion if you're praying during the day, during the week of Hanukkah, or on Shabbat of Hanukkah. And also, besides the Al Hanisim in the silent devotion, you also have it where? In the Berkat HaMazon, the grace after meals. So you're being reminded of it. And as the Talmud said also, God forbid somebody passes away, there's a funeral, then of course the person is properly buried, but the eulogy is cut short. And the mourning practices would be also cut short because it's such a joyous and happy time in the Jewish community.
So you don't sit Shiva at all?
So it cuts it off. Hanukkah actually cuts it off.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if they pass away during Hanukkah, then you don't sit Shiva at all?
If they pass away during Hanukkah, if I'm not mistaken, there's no Shiva as a result. Now it says, hold on, what does it say in the Talmud here? You also can't fast. Why would you fast during these days? What occasion? There's no fast days.
You're getting married.
Okay, let's say you get married during this period of time. We would try probably not to do weddings during Hanukkah. Welcome. How are you? Rabbi Ezra, we were just talking about your Hanukkah party coming up.
Pardon?
Hanukkah party.
Keep teaching. Hey, everybody. He's a great rabbi, great teacher.
Why would there be a fast day?
Say,
if you're getting married, we don't get married during Hanukkah also, because Eim Arvim Simcha B'Simcha, we try not to have smachot banging up against each other. We want to give them their due
respect.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
What if you drop the Torah? Do you really
I was going to say Atanit Chalom. Some people fast if they have an awful, awful dream. There is such an institution. If you have a terrible dream and you want to sort of do tshuva from that and whatever it is.
Like a dream that's a premonition or a dream?
Possibly.
Yeah, it's an interesting institution in Jewish life. We should talk about that another time. Any other questions? Yeah.
Why do you put the candles in left to right? Ah. Or right to left?
I thought you were going to ask why we go one to eight and eight to one.
Right to left.
Because the rabbis write right over everything.
There is a debate between Shammai and Hillel, where you go up or you go down. Why do you start? I don't even know the answer to that question. I can't even do it unless I turn my back to you. It goes.
Wait, you put them in right
here.
To left. Yeah, right, light, left to right.
Rachmanis.
Yeah. I'm not 100%
sure. The way you do your Megillah Shaddai.
Same idea. Is it the same idea, though?
Rachmanis, no.
A God's mercy is associated with left?
Light is.
Okay. I will get back to you on that. I don't know. So why do we light from left to right?
No, we write from right to left.
No.
Yeah, I understand. We go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 instead of 8, 7, 6, 5.
No, she doesn't write light left to right. But you put in the candles right to left.
Oh.
Correct. Right. So you actually kindle the flame from left to right.
Correct. Yeah, where we start.
We still don't know the answer to your question, but now we have the question clear now. Yes.
Do you have to use the shamash to...
You're supposed to use a leader. Now, you could technically just use a match if it's not going to... And the match could be a shamash, too. But what you're not supposed to do is take... I'll tell you why this is in a minute. This is very interesting. You're not supposed to take... Let's say one of your candles blows out in the middle. So you want to light it from one of the other candles. You can't light it from another candle that's lit already. You can only light a new one. Why?
You're not supposed to use the light for anything else.
You're not supposed to use the light for any physical kind of benefit as opposed to what kind of light?
Shabbat.
Shabbat is specifically for physical benefit. And this we're going to end. What is the major difference between Shabbat candles and Hanukkah candles? Shabbat candles are lit specifically to illuminate your home. Talmud says that we're going to get into this in our Shabbos series in a few weeks. It's to create light in a home. There's no shalom bias. There's no peace in a home if there's no light. That's why we light Shabbos candles. And we'll get to that because the little candles and the big lights, that's why you're supposed to really put it in an area where you'll get some kind of illumination from it. But Hanukkah, you're not lighting the candles for benefit of the light. Why are you lighting the candles?
Hanukkah.
To demonstrate the miracle, and you put the menorah where? Place where people can see it. It's not to create light. It's not to benefit. And you actually say that in the song. Hanerot halalu, and it says that lirotam bilvad, they're really just to look at. They're not to benefit physically from, unlike the Shabbat candles, which is really to benefit from the light. So they're really being lit for totally different reasons. One last halakha is that when you light the Hanukkah candles on Friday, which ones do you light first?
Hanukkah or Shabbat?
Like Hanukkah because you're not supposed to light after Shabbat is taken in. You're not supposed to light a candle. And therefore your Hanukkah candles need to be...
out before your Shabbat candles.
Well, not out. They need to be thicker or longer so that they last because Shabbat starts... When are you supposed to light the menorah?
Sundown.
Sundown.
Right? As early... You don't have to come back from work... Like, let's say you get out of work at 6, 7 o'clock, it's already getting dark at 4:30, 5 o'clock. So as soon as you can light your menorah, you should try to do that. By the way, if for whatever reason you can't get home and you have to go somewhere else, you can light the menorah all night. Really, it's supposed to be when people are walking around in Manhattan, that's like all the time. So you can, it's different, I think, in a city like Manhattan because as long as someone can actually theoretically see it, and there'll always be some crazy drunk person outside your apartment you can count on to look at your menorah. So, I know, he's always there for me. I'm sure he's there for you. Well, what was the last thing? Oh, so Friday. So why do your Friday Hanukkah candles have to be thicker or longer?
It has to burn for a little bit.
Right, because the Shabbos candles are what? The Shabbos candles are... We bring in Shabbos early. You know, like... Right, but before sunset, right? And the Hanukkah menorah has to be lit 30 minutes into nightfall. So when you light your Shabbos candles, it's like 45 minutes to an hour before nightfall. So the Hanukkah candles have to be thicker, you know. So I use, I don't know, whatever. First of all, you can use oil that lasts longer. Or you can use like a Shabbos candle and ram it into your menorah. Have you ever done that? You can do that. They're like, just let me go. Yeah, last question.
You see, it's in candles or shellac, I'm drinking oil, but can you use something else that burns, other than oil or...
Like your brother or something? Ideally, it should
like
be oil.
Bacon
oil
with the wick, for instance.
But you can't use wax. Like, what else would you use? Like coal?
Rubbing alcohol won't last.
No, I don't think you can. I think the only non oil substance that can be used is wax.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, any other brilliant questions? Just kidding. That was a good question. I'll try to get you a reason for that for next week, because there is...
I think it's like the new day.
By the way, I won't let you guys go. I'm going to keep you all night. Have a great Chanukah, yes, everyone. Please. We'll see you guys, please God, on Shabbat or next week. And happy Chanukah. Now we know the story.
Don't we have another class now?
Oh, yes. Well, you guys will see it.
Oh, you see it. Great.
Well, yes.
Do you want me to put your
fellows, phone? Another class, correct?
Do you want me to put your phone? And my charger?
Okay, Daron? I have to run, though. Can you get another phone?
Yeah, we'll
Daron, we're going to try to call you from another line.
Perfect. Thank
all right,
you.
It was a pleasure.
It's easier than I dial in. Just let me know.
Okay, I'm going to have Ariel's going to take care of it. Okay, cool.
Thank you so much.
Okay, pleasure.
Sorry to schedule a meeting next week.
Yes, next week I'm totally cool. How are you? What are you guys doing for Hanukkah? What's the plan?
We're around.
Oh.
Yeah. We're around.
You're
going to the holy city of Skyview.
Yeah, to Lindsay's shul. Oh, that means Lindsay's not going because she's here.
Oh, the rich Jews. I'm not.
Oh, okay.
But Ezra's giving us for the fellows, yeah.
Oh,